was to try and get some agreement between the tribes, the settlers, and the British Crown. And so the treaty had the potential to be something of a model for the way that a big superpower like Great Britain should relate to a small nation. And in doing that, the idea was that the interests of all three groups would be protected and that there would be a fair arrangement so that no one became disadvantaged as they interacted with each other. That was the intention. Now, we talked quite a lot about the how the treaty arose and its development. I just really wanted to read the treaty to you so that you can say that at least once in your life you've heard it, and then talk just a little bit about the problem which I referred to earlier on of the translating the two versions, what went wrong, and then how we overcome that problem in New Zealand, because there are ways of overcoming it without arguing all the time. Now, the treaty, very simple document. There's five parts to it, and it's short. By terms of an international treaty, it's a short document. That tells you it wasn't written by a lawyer. It was drafted by a naval captain who was a bit stretched to find the right words from time to time. But it's got a preamble, which is like the introduction, quite important because that sets out the objectives of the treaty. What is it that this is supposed to do? Then there's Article 1, Article 2, Article 3, and the postscript. Postscript is just the end bit. So, in terms of a treaty of this, of the importance of the treaty, it's quite a brief document. So brief that it is really a guideline rather than a set of specific rules and regulations. And by the way, the treaty itself is not a legal document. It's an agreement between two groups. Sometimes it's confused and people say, well, it's not legal, therefore it doesn't exist. It never was intended to be a legal document. It's an agreement between two groups. Now, just the preamble, I'm going to read it through. Don't be, you'll never read that from where you're sitting. Actually, I'll have trouble reading it from here. But it's the longest sentence in New Zealand as far as I know, because the Hobson never put in any commas. And if you, I'm going to just put the commas in as I go along. But you can pick up as I'm reading it what it intended to do. It intended to protect Maori interests, and you'll see that come through. It intended to protect settlers who were already in New Zealand. There were 2,000 of them, and that's mentioned as we go through it. It's intended to be the background. It's intended that a treaty will be signed, and that's spelled out here. It was intended to provide some way of governing the country, some way of getting law and order into the country, so that the lawlessness that the settlers had been demonstrating would come to an end. And it was an opportunity for the chiefs to agree on signing a treaty. So all of those things you'll find probably as I read them through. Anyway, it says, Her Majesty Victoria, Queen of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Ireland, I'm putting the comma in, regarding with her royal favour the native chiefs and tribes of New Zealand, and anxious to protect their just rights and property, and to secure to them the enjoyment of peace and good order, has deemed it necessary, in consequence of the great number of Her Majesty's subjects, who have already settled in New Zealand, and there were about 2,000 British subjects here then, and the rapid extension of emigration both from Europe and Australia, which is still in progress, to constitute and appoint a functionary properly authorised to treat with the Aborigines of New Zealand for the recognition of Her Majesty's sovereign authority over the whole or any part of those islands, Her Majesty therefore being desirous to establish a settled form of civil government with a view to avert the evil consequences which must result from the absence of necessary laws and institutions alike to the native population and to her subjects, has been graciously pleased to empower and to authorise me, William Hobson, a captain in Her Majesty's Royal Navy, consul and lieutenant governor, of such parts of New Zealand as may be or hereafter shall be ceded to Her Majesty, to invite the Confederated and Independent Chiefs of New Zealand to concur in the following articles and conditions. So in using the language of the time, it says, in very broad terms, the purpose of this document, and now the chiefs are invited to agree with these three articles. So that's the preamble. Article 1 is quite brief. The chiefs of the Confederation of the United Tribes of New Zealand, that's a reference to the chiefs who signed the Declaration of Independence. Remember, most chiefs didn't. There are only 35 or 36. So it says, the chiefs of the Confederation of the United Tribes of New Zealand and the separate and independent chiefs who have not become members of the Confederation, that was the majority, cede to Her Majesty, the Queen of England, absolutely and without reservation, all the rights and powers of sovereignty which the said Confederation or individual chiefs respectively exercise or possess, or may be said to exercise or possess, over their respective territories as the sole sovereigns thereof. The point of Article 1, it recognises Māori sovereignty and then invites the chiefs to give their sovereignty without any reservation to the Crown. Article 2, this is the one that Busby has allegedly added. Her Majesty the Queen of England confirms and guarantees to the chiefs and tribes of New Zealand and to the respective families and individuals thereof, the full, exclusive, and undisturbed possession of their lands and estates, forests, fisheries, and other properties which they may individually possess, so long as it is their wish and desire to retain the same in their possession. But the chiefs of the United Tribes and the individual chiefs yield to Her Majesty the exclusive right of preemption over such lands as the proprietors thereof may be disposed to alienate at such prices as may be agreed upon between the respective proprietors and the persons appointed by Her Majesty to treat with them in that behalf. Basically, two parts to this article. The first part says, whatever you own, we guarantee that you can keep it. So that the treaty is in no way to take away your rights. And we guarantee that, and it spells out certain things, lands, estates, forests, fisheries, and other properties. So the first part of Article 2 is a guarantee that your property will not be affected by this deal. The second part of it contradicts the first part just a little bit, because it says if you want to sell your land, you can, but you can only sell it to the Crown. You can't sell it to the person who offers you the best money. You can only sell it to the Crown. This was, of course, one of Hobson's ways of bringing under control the activities of the New Zealand Land Company. So the chiefs could not sell directly to certain buyers. They had to sell to the Crown. So that's Article 2. And Article 3, in consideration thereof, Her Majesty the Queen of England extends to the natives of New Zealand her royal protection and imparts to them all the rights and privileges of British subjects. Now, the point of Article 3 is that this is addressed to Māori people as individuals, not to Māori people as members of tribes, and it gives them rights that they never had before, the rights of citizenship. That is, the right to a fair trial in a court, the right to hold a British passport. Actually, that might have been the end of it. I don't think the DPB had come in then, and the right to a free education wasn't there then. So the Article 3 then is about the rights that individual people will have. Article 2 is a guarantee to the tribes that tribal property will be protected. Article 1 is that the Crown will take sovereignty over New Zealand if you agree with it. Then the postscript. Now we, therefore, the chiefs of the Confederation of the United Tribes of New Zealand, being assembled in Congress at Victoria in Waitangi, the name Victoria never took on, but it was proposed to call that place Victoria, and we, the separate and independent chiefs of New Zealand, claiming authority over the tribes and territories which are specified after our respective names, having been made fully to understand the provisions of the foregoing treaty, accept and enter into the same in the full spirit and meaning thereof, in witness of which we have attached our signatures or marks at the places and the dates respectively specified, done at Waitangi the 6th day of February in the year of our Lord 1840, and then the 512. Only one signature, all the other people signed it with the mark of their tattoo, their moko, so that they had a distinguishing moko, and they'd put some part of the moko there, and the missionary would write the name alongside it. So it was clear who, actually it was not very clear sometimes, but it, to indicate who that person was. And as I said earlier, this was taken all around the country, 43 different locations. And by the first signing was on the 6th of February, but it wasn't completely signed until September. The postscript basically says, we understand what we have signed, which was probably fairly unlikely. Now, I mentioned before that when Williams translated the treaty, he did it in a bit of a hurry, and there were some significant inaccuracies in his translation, which altered the meaning. And in Article 1, this is the article, you remember, where the Crown asks the chiefs to give the sovereignty, their sovereignty, to the Crown. Sovereignty in British thinking is an all-embracing term. Sovereignty is absolute authority. The authority of the British monarch is said to come from God. And so the Britain regards this as an absolute type of authority. America doesn't. America's views of sovereignty are a little bit different. In America, you can have shared sovereignty, so that the Indian people, when they're on their reservation, retain an element of their sovereignty. As soon as they step off at the reservation, they don't. But on the reservation, they have a residual sovereignty. Britain's approach is quite different, that it's an absolute thing. There's only one sovereign. As it happens in Britain, the sovereign has no power whatsoever. It's Parliament, really, that is the has the sovereignty. But it's an absolute type of sovereignty. The Queen shares her sovereignty with no one. So it's a powerful statement. And the significant translation is to do with this phrase, all the rights and powers of sovereignty, because that's what the chiefs are going to give to the Crown. Now, when Williams translated it, he used the phrase, kawanatanga katoa, as an equivalent of all the rights and powers of sovereignty. Now, kawanatanga is a missionary word. It's not a Māori word. If you're translating from one language to another and you can't find the right word, you can either go for one that's pretty close in meaning, or you can make up a new word. There were no sheep in New Zealand, you see, before the missionaries came, and so the word for sheep is hippie. Sounds like sheep. And the word for cow is ko. Sounds like cow. That's called a transliteration. And kawanatanga is on the same lines. It's a transliteration of the word governance. Kawana sounds like governor. And when they translated the Bible and got to Pontius Pilate, he was referred to as kawana, governor Pontius Pilate. So there would have been some familiarity with the word kawanatanga, but it is essentially to do with governance. Governance is not the same as sovereignty. And you remember in the Declaration of Independence, the idea was that Britain would act to protect Maori interests. The notion of governance would have been quite consistent with that. So what Williams did by using the word kawanatanga, he took a word which is of lesser authority than the word sovereignty. So although the tribes, the chiefs were giving something, in the English version they were giving total sovereignty. In the Māori version they were giving the right to govern, which is something a bit less than what the English implies. The other problem comes in Article 2. And in this phrase, the full, exclusive, and undisturbed possession of their lands and estates and so on. The phrase, full, exclusive, and undisturbed possession, is the important one. And that was translated by Williams as te tino rangatiratanga. Now, te tino rangatiratanga is a very powerful phrase, which doesn't just talk about possession, but talks about absolute authority. So you've got this rather peculiar situation that in Article 2, the Maori version says to the chiefs, you can have absolute authority over your own affairs. And that contradicts the English version of Article 1, which says that the Crown has absolute authority. So there is a serious conflict there in meaning between the English and the Maori versions. And just there were other problems as well, but not nearly as significant as that. And I won't go into all of that. But you can see that we're left with some problems. Most of those notes there are designed for my class at Massey University, and they tend to fail if they don't know all those things. But you're not confronted with an exam, so I'm not... Now, the point is then we've got a treaty written in two languages that don't add up. The English version is absolutely clear. The sovereignty goes to the Crown, and the Crown will protect Maori property. The Maori version, the chiefs give the right to govern to the Crown, which is something less than authority, but retain full authority over their own matters, their own affairs. So it's quite a difference in meaning. Now, how do we go? The good news is that we're not the only country in the world with this problem. In fact, wherever treaties have been signed between a colonising country and a colonised country, this problem has arisen. Whenever you've got treaties in two languages, you'll find the translations are often contradictory. So we're not on our own. And there has developed around the world ways of handling this problem. One way is that you disregard one version entirely. And the tendency in New Zealand in the early colonial days was to only place emphasis on the English version because that's the one that Hobson signed, and he didn't really understand the Maori version and place no importance on it. Most Maori claimants who go to the Waitangi Tribunal say, oh, we didn't sign the English version. Only 39 chiefs signed the English version, so we'll only look at the Maori version. Now, well, Tainui, of course, when they were going for their fishing thing, went for the English version, which they signed, because that spells out fisheries. The Maori version doesn't. But that aside, this approach doesn't take you anywhere except into an argument. So that you can say, well, your version's not the right one, ours is the right one, and you can argue that forever, but that argument sort of doesn't go anywhere. So it's not a very fruitful solution. What many countries overseas use is a rule they call the contra pro forentum rule. And this rule basically says that if you've got a treaty written in two languages and there's a problem between them, you give priority to the version that's written in the language of the party that did not draw up the treaty. It presumes that if you didn't draw up the treaty, you were a passive partner, then you're at a disadvantage. So that this is Lord McNair's rule, the contra pro forentum rule. Give priority to the treaty, to the version written in the language of the party that did not draw up the treaty. We don't practice this in New Zealand. This is not our approach, although it is an international approach and is favoured by many countries. New Zealand has its own way of doing it. It's the number 8 wire approach. Which actually has been noted around the world as quite an innovative approach. And many countries around the world are interested in how we do it because they think it takes us somewhere. What we do is to recognise the method contained in the Treaty of Waitangi Act 1975. This was the act passed in the time of Norman Kirk, sponsored by Matt Rata, the late Matt Rata, which established the Waitangi Tribunal. And in that act, the tribunal is given instructions about how it is to regard the treaty. And that's the approach that now is the dominant approach in New Zealand to reconciling these differences between the two versions. And I'll explain it. It's quite simple. But what the Act says is that the Waitangi Tribunal must have equal regard to both texts of the treaty. It can't say that one is more important than the other. They're both equally important. So that's the first point it makes. The second point it makes is that if there's a problem, you should try and understand get the meaning by blending the texts. Now, actually, no one knows what that means, and it's never been done. So that's the unhelpful part of this Act. But the third point that it makes is that to understand the full meaning of the treaty, you should examine the principles of the treaty as much as the words of the treaty. Try and go behind the words and the different versions and understand what are the underlying principles that the treaty stands for. And that's the approach that the Waitangi Tribunal uses, and that's the approach that is quite distinctive to New Zealand and has attracted a considerable amount of attention. It's got some flaws, because who says what the principles are? Well, in this Act, the Waitangi Tribunal is given the authority to say what the principles are, but just about everyone has a go at formulating their own principles. And the Court has formulated principles, and the Royal Commission on Social Policy formulated principles, and the government, David Longley's government, one of the last things that David Longley did as Prime Minister before he and Margaret went overseas was to formulate a set of principles which became the government's principles, so that a lot of people have had to go at principles. Some of them stand out more than others. So I'm just... There are some principles that you see coming up all over again, over and over again, and one is the principle of partnership. And that has been emphasised in several Waitangi Tribunal reports, and it was a major principle articulated by the Court of Appeal in 1987. So this notion of partnership is one principle. There are some problems with it as well. Who are the partners? And not always easy to tell who the partners are. The government has huge trouble finding out who the Māori partner is. They figure it might be a tribe. Is it a tribe? Is it all Māori people? If it's a tribe, who do you talk to? Because there's sometimes more than one voice within a tribe. And the only thing the government can be sure about is that whoever they're talking to is the wrong person. So that they have quite a lot of trouble locating the partner. Now, Māori have had the same trouble. In 1892, a delegation set out from New Zealand to London, led by King Tawhiyo, second Māori king. And they were concerned about the disregard for the treaty. And so they said, well, we'll go and find our partner who we believe is the Crown. And we understand that the Crown's in London. So they went to London to find the partner to the Treaty of Waitangi. And they got to see Queen Victoria. They got an audience with her. This was in 1892. And apparently she was very gracious to them and gave them a cup of tea. And then explained that although she wore the crown, she wasn't actually the crown. Which was a little difficult for the chiefs to understand. And I'm sure if they had been alive much later, they would have described this as a type of Clayton's chief. Someone who looked like the real thing but really wasn't. No, she said, I'm not the crown. My ministers are the people you should see. So she then arranged for this delegation of chiefs to meet the Prime Minister and the minister who had responsibility for colonial affairs. So they met these two people, and they were very good to them as well, but then explained that this was a long trip they had made, 12,000 miles, when they needed only to have made a trip of 300 miles, because the Crown is in Wellington, not in London. By then, you see, New Zealand had become a self-governing colony, and from Britain's point of view, the authority of the Crown was now vested in the New Zealand Parliament. So the chief said, but we've been there. They didn't look like the Crown to us, and they didn't seem to act like the Crown. But nonetheless, you should go back there. So they went back to New Zealand and went to Wellington, and eventually, over the years, a dialogue began to develop between the tribes and the Crown, But then in 1984, when the restructuring came on in a big way, the Crown devolved itself. So now it's a little bit hard still to find out who the Crown is. Is the Crown a district health board? Is the Crown a school board of governors? Is the Crown the Hamilton City Council? It's not quite clear who the Crown is from my point of view. The only thing you can be sure about, whichever office you're in, is the wrong office. So although this notion of partnership is a sound principle, and it's been articulated by authoritative people, making it work and identifying the partners, we're still in an exploratory state to a large extent with that. There are other principles as well, which I won't go into, except to note that participation is one, that the expectation was that Māori would participate fully in New Zealand's activities. And, of course, the principle of protection, which is that the Crown always undertook to protect Māori interests in an active way. So there are three principles that have been much talked about, particularly that was the government's principles. But I just want to touch on another point before, and it is this one, that apart from the principles, the other one to understand the treaty is to talk about what the treaty actually provides for. And if you look at this article by article, you see that Article 1 provides for the Crown's authority. You can argue about whether the authority is based on sovereignty or based on the right to govern. It might be a small shade of difference in practice. But for whatever reason, Article 1 gives the Crown some authority. The power of government comes from Article 1 of the treaty. If you want to govern a country, you can do it in two ways. You can come in with the guns blazing and take it by force, or you can sign a treaty and take it another way. So really, the legitimacy of the New Zealand government comes from Article 1 of the treaty, in theory. In practice, governments get legitimacy from just by hanging around long enough. And you know, where there's a revolution around the world and a rebel government comes in, New Zealand's first reaction is not to recognise the rebel government. But if they're still there in 2 or 3 years' time and we need another trading partner, we tend to recognise them. But the New Zealand government's, in theory, their authority comes from Article 1. Article 2 is about the authority that tribes have. And Article 3 is about the status of Māori people, not as tribal members, but as individual people. The problem is that the boundary between the power of government and the authority of tribes is not always very clear. And that's what the discussions that go on in Wellington day after day after day are all about. Where does the authority of the government end and where does the authority of tribes start? So there's one problem there. The other problem is, where does the authority of tribes end and where does the status of Māori people as individuals start? And you may be familiar with some of the debate about the distribution of the assets of sea lords and New Zealand fishing rights, which is basically about that position. What are the relative rights of tribes as against Māori people as individuals? And so there's some lack of clarity there. Well, now that really was all I was wanting to discuss with you this morning, was to give a background, first of all, to the Treaty of Waitangi, a brief description of what the treaty actually says and how we tackle the problem of two different versions of the treaty and get a way that we can make progress on. What I was going to suggest then was that there may be particular points now that you want to put on an agenda for us to discuss this afternoon. If there aren't, there's several other things I could do. But it might be useful if there are, and perhaps we could use that time at lunch to construct an agenda and to focus on those things in the afternoon. So I might, from my point of view, leave it there for now and hand it back to Monty.
We turn our Bibles to Joshua 9. Joshua chapter 9. Now Now we know the story that Joshua had crossed the Jordan and was now in the process of taking the land back. And he had conquered a number of people. And there was this group of, just in verse 3. However, when the people of Gibeon heard what Joshua had done to Jericho and Ai, they resorted to a ruse. They went as a delegation, whose donkeys were loaded with worn-out sacks and old wineskins, cracked and mended. The men put worn and patched sandals on their feet and wore clothes. All the bread of their food supply was dry and moldy. Then they went to Joshua in the camp at Gilgal and said to him and the men of Israel, "We have come from a distant country. Make a treaty with us." So the Gibeonites came to Joshua to make a treaty. The men of Israel said to the Hivites, "But perhaps you live near us. How then can we make a treaty with you?" "We are your servants," they said to Joshua. But Joshua asked, "Who are you, and where do you come from?" They answered, "Your servants have come from a very distant country, because of the fame of the Lord your God, for we have heard reports of him, all that he had done in Egypt, and all that he did to the two kings of the Amorites east of the Jordan." Again, they repeat the comment in verse 11, "We are your servants, make a treaty with us." Verse 12, "This bread of ours was warm when we packed it at home on the day we left to come to you. But now see how dry and moldy it is. And these wineskins that we filled were new, but see how cracked they are. And our clothes and sandals are worn out by the very long journey." The men of Israel sampled their provisions, but did not inquire of the Lord. They didn't ask the Lord for anything. Then Joshua, verse 15, "Then Joshua made a treaty of peace with them to let them live. And the leaders of the assembly ratified it by oath." Later on, of course, Joshua finds out that he was actually tricked into making a treaty with the Gibeonites. In fact, in verse 16, it says, 3 days after they made the treaty with the Gibeonites, the Israelites heard that they were neighbors living near them. So the Israelites set out, and on the third day came to these various cities. But the Israelites did not attack them because the leaders of the assembly had sworn an oath to them by the Lord, the God of Israel. In other words, they kept and honored the treaty. Although they were tricked into making that treaty, they honored it. They honored it. Okay. Now let's turn to 2 Samuel 21. I think in years, I think we're talking about maybe 400 years later. The time from Joshua to David. Verse 1, it says that during the reign of David, there was a famine for 3 successive years. Can you imagine that? A famine for 3 years? So David sought the face of the Lord. So he sought God. The Lord said, he said, God, you know, he asked God, why are we having this famine? The Lord said, "It is on account of Saul and his blood-stained house. It is because he put the Gibeonites to death." Remember that made this treaty with the Gibeonites 400 years before. Now they're having a drought in the land because Saul killed some of the Gibeonites. The treaty was that the Israelites would never kill the Gibeonites. That was the treaty. An imperfect treaty, tricked into making that treaty, but God is still saying 400 years later, you have to honor that treaty. Because if you don't, I will bring a famine to your land. Well, that's huge, really. Interesting thing, and here's the king of the Jews, David. He summons the Gibeonites because he wants to speak to them. Verse 3, David asked the Gibeonites, what shall I do for you? In other words, he has a heart to put this right. What shall I do for you? How shall I make amends so that you will bless the Lord's inheritance? So he wants the famine to finish, and he wants the Lord's blessings. Interesting answer in verse 4. This is a really interesting answer, the Gibeonites answering. The Gibeonites answered him, we have no right to demand silver or gold from Saul. In other words, they didn't want money. They didn't want money. Or his family. Nor do we have the right to put anyone in Israel to death. It's an interesting answer. So David, he says, what do you want me to do for you? In other translations it says, listen, I will do anything. I will do anything for you. Okay. I think he was quite relieved that they didn't want any silver and gold. You know, he's really quite relieved about that. So he said, listen, I'll give you anything. They answered the king, as for the man who destroyed us and plotted against us, so that we have been decimated and have no place anywhere in Israel, let 7 of his male descendants be given to us to be killed and exposed before the Lord at Gilboa, the Lord's chosen one. In other words, this is, we don't want your gold, we don't want your silver, but give us 7 male descendants. And in some translations it says, to be hanged before the Lord as restitution. So the king said, I will give them to you. Now he doesn't give Jonathan because he's already made an agreement with Jonathan previously. But he does give 7 male descendants of Saul to be hanged unto the Lord as restitution for a broken treaty, which was imperfect. They were tricked into making it. So it was, it's not about a perfect treaty, but it's about a treaty and an honoring of a treaty. And of course, when all of the things were done, you can read later on in the passage, when all of that was done, the famine ceased in Israel. So the question is, you know, how does this relate to the Treaty of Waitangi? I suppose there are a lot of parallels here. One was the treaty is not a perfect treaty. Neither was the treaty with the Gibeonites a perfect treaty. But nevertheless, it was a treaty that God wanted to be honored. The treaty was made in New Zealand, an agreement between two nations, as this was, an agreement between two nations. Does God want us to honor the treaty? If so, and how does he want us to honor it? Is it still relevant? After all, it's 100 and how many years later? Remember, in the case of the Gibeonites, we're talking about 400 years later, when the Lord still wanted the treaty to be honored. The question we have to ask ourselves is this book the book of truth? Is this book, the Bible, the book that we should live by in New Zealand? Should we honor this book and what it says? Or should we just throw it away and just live according to our rules and our regulations in New Zealand, our policies, man-made? These are the questions that are confronting us right now in our country. And today, my prayer today is that all of you will be much more knowledgeable about the treaty at the end of this day. And also that you will be able to articulate, really, that is Mason's heart, that you are able to articulate what he is saying in here. Not just to listen and to say, oh, that was really good, but to become part of the disciples, if you like, for want of a better word, of the treaty. And to be able to articulate, maybe not in its entirety, but, you know, a lot of important statements that Mason will make today. When we were organizing this meeting, Alan and I were talking about things, and we thought it would be really good to hold a Treaty of Waitangi seminar, especially for our Christian brothers and sisters, because it is important to have the knowledge, to have the right ideas, to, you know, and not to be pontificating or just, you know, plucking things from out of the air. It's not the time for that, actually. The time now is to become very factual, to get the facts, to go from there, rather than to go from some kind of you know, ideas based or notions based approach. So I suppose what I wanted to do was to say that the Treaty of Waitangi is biblical. It is part of God's plan, and we as Christians now need to think about where we stand in this particular area. Kia ora.